So it's been 5 years since I saw you last.
That's right, yeah.
You haven't aged a bit.
Nor you.
Yes, I have. And you haven't been... I think we talked about Money, major book.
Yeah.
So you haven't been resting on your laurels. You've been... were you working in London Fields most of this period?
Yeah, it took a long time. I did. I mean, it was interrupted by a book of short stories and two babies. But, takes some recovering from. But, yeah, 5 years it took. Very intensive the last 2 years.
When did the book come out in London?
Last fall.
Last fall. It became a success there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How does a success in England compare to a success in the United States? So England's such a small country.
Well, there used to be no comparison. A success in London used to mean that you had lunch with your publisher, and maybe you bought a new filing cabinet and a new typewriter, maybe. Whereas success in America meant your life was entirely transformed. Now it's narrowing the gap. English letters are, the corporations have come in there too, and for the time being, biggish sums of money are winging around. Your life, could change, I imagine, if you let it.
Well, the fact of the matter is, writing books in this country is not a profitable profession. Although once in a while, a writer will strike it rich. Mario Puzo wrote The Godfather, will be living on that book for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
All you need is one big book, and you can live on it the rest of your life. But the fact of the matter is, for most literary authors, that just doesn't happen. And most writers have to do other things to support themselves. And normally they teach, or one writer I met, a young man named Larry Brown, is a fire captain, or was a fire captain until January, in a small town in Alabama. And because he worked 24 hours on and 24 hours off, he had longer stretches of time to write, but here is a guy, a fireman, to finance his writing habit. So I would imagine it would not be that much different in Britain.
Well, the second profession that the writers who do well have to have now is they give interviews. That seems to be what you do instead of being a school teacher or a journalist. You spend half your life taking the book on the road. Writers today do more self-explication than any other writers in history.
Well, I was reading a profile of you, I believe it was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and it said that you had kind of an awkward, antagonistic relationship with the press. Is that true?
Nah, it's based on a couple of interviews that went wrong. And even those were friendly enough. I mean, I get up people's noses sometimes, and I've cobbled together this response, which is that it's not me, it's the writing that somehow prickles them. And then the interview is conducted with the usual good humor, but then they go home and beat me up on their typewriters for something to do with the feeling that if they stepped into a novel by me, they would get badly mauled, and things that they don't, that they're anxious about themselves come out. That's the only way I can explain it, because these interviews are never rancorous, but often the written result is extremely rancorous.
Well, the purpose of the interviews is to, like this interview, to promote the book. Is that it?
Yeah. And perhaps I don't give the interviewer that sort of respect they feel they deserve for the promotion they're giving me. But I mean, those were fairly early days now, and I'm a bit more careful not to antagonize people simply for a quiet life. But I don't perhaps show the gratitude I should.
So you're saying that some of the interviews you've done have resulted in unfriendly or unflattering articles in the press in England?
Yeah. for instance, you know, I happen to be 5'6" tall, but that height has been slashed by many a profile writer. I've been told I'm 5'1", 5'2", 4'11", you know. And these inches don't matter much if you're 6 foot, but let me tell you, when you're around 5'6", every millimeter is priceless.
So they do that to get your goat, I would assume.
That's right. Well, it's, yeah, they want to, I don't know. I make them feel small in some way, and they therefore make me literally small in response.
Well, let's talk about things that really matter, namely London Fields. This is the story of a murderer, and I believe your phrase is murderee. Tell me about how you got the idea for this book.
Well, I think I just about trace it back to something I read maybe 8-10 years ago, a book, a review of a book that put forward the theory that people who are murdered, this wouldn't be the sort of senseless murder kind of murder, but people who are murdered are psychologically or even genetically predisposed to being murdered. Now, once I got writing, once the novel took over a bit, it occurred to me that what would be really interesting would be to have someone plan their own murder, as you might even plan a work of art. You know, you would, far from it being a senseless murder, you would give it shape and form and meaning. In the case of the heroine of this novel, it's kind of a proxy suicide. She doesn't want to kill herself, and she wants to go out with a bang, and she wants to take a couple of people with her, and she wants to make a point.
And you and the two villains are quite disparate, aren't they? Tell me about them.
Guy and Keith. Keith is the obvious villain.
Champion dart player.
Dart player. Cheat. He's a professional cheat. His life is conning, skanking. I created him with every intention of him having not one redeeming quality, almost as a chance to see how far you could go in that direction, how totally worthless a character could be. And in fact, of course, he's easily the most popular character in the book, and he's the one that the readers enjoy most. The other villain, or he's rather, he's a victim who is goaded into the position where he might turn nasty, is a remnant of the British aristocracy, a bookish, withdrawn, reserved sort of person who married young, has no sexual or erotic experience. And with the brutish character Keith, the girl manipulates him through sex, and with the upper class character, she manipulates him through love, both passionlessly in her case. I mean, she is one of these women. She's sort of a, people say she's a male sexual fantasy. She isn't really. I mean, she's a nightmare in a sense, because she has seen through men. As she puts it, she's come to the end of men. She knows how pitifully easy men are to manipulate, sexually or romantically.
Nicola Six. Gaius has one of the most objectionable children in literature.
Marmaduke. Well, there are two, as always, in my fiction, I paint with strong, you know, primary colors. Every parent knows that each child is both heaven and hell at the same time, in a, you know, little, in the same package. And that package is usually a diaper, and it's usually a full diaper. But the child is both heaven and hell. For the purposes of this novel, I made one child heaven and one child hell. And Marmaduke is hell. But almost every parent I know who's read it say that they often suspect that they've got a Marmaduke on their hands.
Your narrator is an American writer. He's very peripatetic, of course, because he knows all the ins and outs of all of the characters. He seems to be dying. Does he have AIDS?
No. His father worked in the nuclear program in England that produced the H-bomb in the 50s. It's not very specifically gone into, but it's there in the text. And the suggestion is that he is part of a leukemia cluster or a cancer cluster. This is just coming out now in England, this last month, the hard evidence for people who work near nuclear weapons installations. The men give leukemia to their children via the sperm. It's at last being tracked down. It's long been suspected. And he was originally a victim of that.
Why did you elect to use an American as a narrator?
Well, I wanted... It started off as a technical reason in that I wanted someone who had been absent from England for some time. The novel is set in 1999, and I wanted him to have been away for about 10 years, i.e. the same time span between now and when the novel is set, so that he would be constantly remarking on changes. Of course, I could have had an Englishman who had been away, but then it seemed to me very appealing that... An American Jewish writer, you know, we associate the American Jewish novel with tremendous energy, tremendous, as you say, you know, peripatetic energy, inclusiveness. But here's a Jewish American writer who's writing a long novel about a sordid tale set in just a few streets of West London. I thought that would be a nice inversion.
Also, it's you created a character who is an outsider looking in.
Exactly.
So he's more dispassionate about what he sees.
Yeah, dispassionate in a way, although he gets, as you know, drawn into he in fact is singled out by the girl long ago for ulterior purposes.
This is a big book. Tell me how you approach the craft of actually sitting down there and putting words to paper.
Well, it's what I want to do when I wake up in the morning. If you were ever a smoker, you'll understand what I mean when I say, you know, once I've had my breakfast and my cup of coffee, the desire to write is as palpable as the desire for the first cigarette. It's what I want to do. So people always imagine that you have this, you know, roster or timetable, but I go straight to this flat where I work and sit around and wait, really. And then the sentences either come or they don't.
Do you have a pretty good idea about how everything is going to tie up at the end?
I know about the ending and I know about the beginning, but I don't know much usually about the middle. And in this case, the middle is 400 pages worth. So it's like a journey. You know that story about journalists who go to hot spots in the world have writer in their passport as their job description, but sometimes change it to waiter if they're going somewhere dangerous. But I think they're almost interchangeable. A writer is a waiter. He is not waiting on table, but he's waiting on his typewriter. You're just sitting around waiting for it to come. That's how it feels for me.
I was talking to a writer, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he is... Highly regarded, I guess you would call him a kind of, he writes black comedy. His name is James Purdy. He's very popular in England, actually. The best known book is Malcolm. But he was telling me once, he said, I write every day. I sit at my manual typewriter. He lives in a garret in Brooklyn. Literally, I walk five flights up to see this man. He's spent all of his life virtually penniless, but writing every day. He says, I sit at my typewriter every day, and he says, sometimes nothing much comes. But every year or so, there's a new book or a new collection of poetry or an off-Broadway play. So he manages to do it somehow, even though nothing much comes.
Yeah, I mean, people, it's great because people think you work very hard, but in fact, it doesn't feel like that. I mean, half the time you're scratching your head or picking your nose or looking out the window, and then suddenly... You do scribble down another line or two.
The pages
to climb up. I'm one of these people who really does believe that everyone has a novel in them, at least one novel in them. The difference between the writer and the non-writer is that the writer finishes the thing. That you have some kind of confidence that means you don't panic as you're writing. Panicking is the danger, I think. You just know that the novel is there in some ghostly form, and you've just got to be patient and let it come to you. Don't try and drag it there by the hair.
But writing seems so hard. Every time I write, I'm an amateur writer, and I love trying to write, and I especially love reading, but as I write, it seems so hard. I think what is really hard is the first words that you put down. Going back and fixing them seems to be the most fun for me.
Yeah, well, I would always, as advice to writers, I would always say, don't worry until it's done. Then you can worry. But don't... Some people are too clever to write. That's another thing. Every sentence they write down, they sense a dozen objections to it, you know. Their intelligence won't relax. And it's not a performing art, but it does have affinities with the performing arts. There is such a thing. These hippie-ish words like flow and so on do matter. You've got to let it come. Auden used to describe writing a poem as scraping away on a dusty bit of stone to see the letters that were written there. And when writing is going at its best, you always feel that in fact the work actually existed before, and you were just a conduit. You're not the mother, you're the midwife. Mm-hmm. And your job is to get it out in as good a shape as possible. And
I'll tell you a little anecdote. Many years ago, I was working a early morning shift as a writer for this radio station, and one of the stable of maybe five or six writers we had on this broadcast was a man who is now the editor of the New York Post, a man by the name of Jerry Nachman, who weighs about 800 pounds and who only weighed maybe 450 pounds when I knew him 12 or 15 years ago. Anyway, he had the ability to turn out copy. Now, we're talking about news copy, but his copy was terribly clever. He had puns and one-liners that would flow out of this typewriter, and the news director would come out and he'd say, look at this, this is terrific copy. Can't the rest of you write like Nachman? So I said, well, I can write like Nachman. So we had typewriters instead of word processors, so I began to look for puns and clever lines, and it took me forever. I mean, I would always get late. I would start missing a deadline as I would try to be so clever. And then I found out that half of my stuff wasn't clever at all. I mean, it just dropped. And then I realized, I can't write like this guy. I mean, this guy had the ability to turn out copy that was so interesting and so clever, and all I could do was just a relatively straight, factual copy. So I decided at that time, no more. I'm going to stay on deadline and just be myself. Of course, now he's the editor of the New York Post, and I'm still here.
Yeah, well, facility and gift are mysterious things. And there's people who pun all the time. Apparently there's a perfectly satisfactory physiological explanation for that. It's something to do with pressure on the cortex, or some bit of the brain is overactive. And I think we can dismiss those sort of punning types anyway, can't we? The lowest form of wit.
We talked about a little of this 5 years ago. It was about your father. How did he? Was he able to get through London Fields?
No, he didn't make it. No. I think he gave it his best shot. And I saw it when I go to his house. I used to peek into his study, and by his reading chair, I saw my book. And he'd done damn well. He'd done about 80 pages, I think. But I could imagine that it was hard work for him.
I bet he's very proud of you.
Yeah, he is. I think he is. But it's really this question of literary amour propre, or sort of self-love, in that, you know, you hate to see the younger writers coming along. And I always thought that this wouldn't apply if it were your own child. But apparently it does.
Oh, you're saying there is a degree of rivalry?
It's not rivalry. It's just that it's with sort of weariness and a slight disgust that you see these, you know, novelists with preposterously recent dates of birth. You know, people who are born in, you know, 1968 are publishing novels, and you think, no, you know, why don't they shut up? Why don't they go away? Why don't they leave me alone? And I think for him, it's a drag to see his son sort of coming, you know, up.
Well, there's a group of writers known, I think they're called the Brat Pack here. They include Tama Janowitz and Jay McInerney, and there are several others, Brad Easton Ellis, and I know almost all of these, but they're all very young. I mean, they almost all of them wrote their first novels when they were 19 or 20, and they got them published somehow. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. I don't know in the long run if they're going to hold up. They've written about very contemporary themes and problems that would appeal to people of their age, and how they are going to mature as writers, it's just not known. There's a lot of criticism of them, critical. I mean, the critics have sometimes really gone down on these writers, so it's kind of hard. But it is kind of startling to see someone who's 22 and he's got a best-selling book and doesn't have to work anymore.
Appalling, yeah. Well, I mean, my first novel, I got an advance of £250. And the book came out, and I went and got the newspapers on the Thursday it was published, and on the Sunday, following Sunday, I read the reviews, and that was that. And by that time, I was halfway through the second novel. But the Brat Pack writers you refer to have had, you know, as we began by saying, have had their lives irretrievably altered by the attention and money that they got first time out.
These guys, you see them in their photographs are in the newspaper, in the society columns. You see them at parties all the time. You wonder when they have time to write.
Well, exactly, and also what they're going to write about. Because, you know, I started very young, too, but it didn't really affect my life much.
You're still young, though. You're barely 40.
40, yeah. And I've been doing it for a while. And I get this feeling often that every time I finish a novel, I'm completely out of gas. You know, I haven't got a thought in my head or an experience in my life that I haven't used. Whereas a writer like William Golding, the Nobel Prize-winning English writer, he wrote his first novel when he was older than I am now. And I think he must have a lot more in the tank, you know.
Well, your father is a case in point, too. He keeps turning them out.
Yes, he does. He's 67, but he started when he was 33 or 4. What I'm saying is the Brat Pack writers have no other experience other than being successful young writers, which is a limited subject, whatever Philip Roth.
That's right. We look at the life of Graham Greene, who traveled the globe looking for ideas and meeting people and developing themes for books. That's really what kept him in business, isn't it?
Yeah. He was, you know, able to write these prescient novels that the whole planet was somewhere he felt at home in, not the Upper East Side.
That's right. These young writers are, I guess, they're going to know the cocktail circuit in Manhattan.
Well, what they won't have is anonymity, and you sort of need that to observe. You need to be able to be unnoticed.
But how much anonymity do you have in England? Here you're anonymous to a degree, but in England, it's a small country. London's not a small city, but still, how many celebrities are there every day?
I know Jay McInerney a little bit, and he says that he's shameless about ringing up a restaurant and getting a good table because he's who he is. But I've never even tried, and I think it would be humiliating if I did to try and get a good table because of who I am. It just doesn't work like that in London. London isn't fueled by fame and celebrity the way New York is. You know, once a month, someone might come up to me somewhere and say, I like your stuff, and that's it. It doesn't affect my life at all.
Well, interesting. I was talking to E.L. Doctorow, who's one of our really great writers, and he was saying I am anonymous. This mic works. Said I can walk down Fifth Avenue, and around me are thousands of people, and nobody recognizes me. And even if somebody recognizes me, the chances are they've never even read my books. And in some respects, most writers do adopt this sense of anonymity. Alison Lurie is another one of this country's great writers, and she's a little woman, a middle-aged woman. She's going to leave the CBS building, and nobody's going to notice her, pay attention to her, and the vast majority have never even read her books.
No. No, we're all an acquired taste, and perhaps it's only, what, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, who would cause a stir.
Yeah, there are some celebrity writers who... Gore Vidal ran for Congress once. Norman Mailer ran for mayor of New York. I mean, you have to be a very special person to seek that kind of notoriety. Well, let me ask you something. There was a new book that came out a little while ago. It was called Stolen Words, and it dealt with plagiarism. And the case, the Jacob Epstein case, was recounted in this book again. And you were a victim of Jacob. I think your book was called The Rachel Papers, wasn't it?
That's right.
How did it happen? We didn't talk about it at the time you were here last, but how did you discover that Jacob Epstein had plagiarized your book?
Well, I read his book. I think that's probably, you know, one of the, perhaps the only way that plagiarism is ever discovered, is that the writer himself, unless it's, you know, grotesque, word-for-word plagiarism, because the writer is the only one who knows his own stuff well enough to detect it. And it was a very odd feeling. But I think...
I was going to ask you, as you're reading Epstein's book, what was it called?
Wild Oats.
Yeah. As you're reading this book, did you have the feeling that, gosh, this sounds familiar, or reads in a familiar way?
Oh, no, more than that. I mean, I thought that's from me. And it was, I didn't mind at first, and then I thought this was, you know, flattering in a way. And then a certain point was reached and then passed, and I thought, this isn't right.
And then what did you do? Did you write a letter?
I wrote a piece about it. But, I mean, plagiarism is morally weird. And you're mistaken, really, when you say that I was the victim of it, because I wasn't the victim of it. He was the victim of it.
Yes, he really was. Although I understand he is now a television writer in Los Angeles and doing quite well, I think.
I hear and hope he's doing tremendously well. But that's not really the point, in that it's a great self-damaging, you know, what is it, a sin, plagiarism, but you're the one who... I can't think of a good outcome, you know, because once a book does well, if it's plagiarized other books, then it's eventually going to come out. And if the book sinks without trace, then why bother anyway?
The premise of this book, Stolen Words, written by Thomas Mallow, I think...
Yes, I spoke to him. He called me.
Was that the plagiarist is self-destructive and often wants to be caught.
Yeah, I think it must be something to do with that. Because, you know, why do it? Why bother?
Unless it was truly a mistake, but apparently there was so much of your material in that book that it couldn't have been just cross notes or something like that.
No, it wasn't a mistake. That is more incredible, really, than you know, someone actually sitting down and transcribing word for word someone else's book. I mean, it's whatever you might come across something in your notebook that you're not sure of its provenance, but you know. One thing you know is that whether you wrote it or not, whether it's yours. No, I think it's extremely mysterious, the motivation.
Would you have legal grounds against Epstein?
I didn't even look into that. I wasn't going to pursue it to that extent. In fact, now I wish I had kept my mouth shut, really. I think, you know, he suffered more than... inordinately, and there was, it didn't do me any good, because in fact you tend to get blamed yourself if you're plagiarized.
Well, I would think, no, I could be wrong about this, I would, I'm sorry, what was that last line?
The plagiary, as it were, is the one who gets mud in his face somehow. He gets blamed.
Well, I would think that it would, of course, that damages his reputation tremendously, and I would think that anything he would produce after Wild Oats would be difficult for him to market. I mean, people would look at it skeptically, saying, well, I don't know, did you really do this? I would think, I don't know that would be a fact, but I, as far as I know, he has not published anything since that book.
No, he hasn't. Another, well, D.M. Thomas is another writer who's always sailing close to the wind here. He obviously has this sort of kleptomaniac weakness, but he somehow rides it out and confesses to a certain, you know, sticky-finger sort of attitude to other people's writing.
I know there were some suspicions raised about the White Hotel, but it, whatever he used, he manipulated in an extremely original way.
Well, there's a big chunk of the book called Babillard in the White Hotel. And
but that Babillard was a factual presentation of what happened there, and he used some of that and integrated it with his own literary impulse. And,
well, he did acknowledge it in tiny print at the end of the book, but the fact remains there is an awful big chunk of completely unreprocessed Babillard in the middle of it. Then he did it again with his next book, and every time he publishes a book, there's some sort of little bit of a rumble about this. But he writes it out, and I would like to think that, you know, if Jacob Epstein